space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? All the symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to our last monthly public lecture of 2006. We decided to opt for the low-hanging fruit this evening and have a public lecture that was based upon issues of overwhelming import and interest to society. It's all very easy to sell out a hall when you're talking about Gödel and Turing and quasi-crystals and so forth, but we thought it was a bit more of a challenge to do something that was on everybody's minds. So it's a pleasure to see you all here this evening. Our speaker this evening is Professor David Archer. Professor Archer is a computational oceanographer from the University of Chicago. He received his PhD from the University of Washington before moving on to do a postdoctoral fellowship at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, where he is still adjunct professor. From there, he moved to the University of Chicago, where he has remained ever since and is now a full professor in the Department of Geophysical Sciences. Professor Archer has also written a book. In fact, he's written several. His most recent book has just come out very, very recently. It's entitled Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast. And this evening, he will speak to us on global warming in geological time from here to eternity. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor David Archer.
Thank you very much for that that introduction and your hospitality today. I can't tell you how humbled I am to be invited to speak in this prestigious lecture series. My sister asked me over Thanksgiving dinner a couple weeks ago if I still get nervous talking in front of people like this. I said, oh yeah. So what I wanted to tell you about is the issue of global warming as it faces us in the sort of foreseeable future, but also I wanted to try to convey to you something of how an earth scientist looks at an issue like this within the context of larger periods of geologic time. So we'll start with the present and what the forecast holds, and then we'll sort of expand out. The global warming forecast is nothing new. This is the first page of a paper published in 1896 by a Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius, an astonishing paper. He predicted that doubling the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere would raise the temperature of the Earth by about 4 to 6 degrees centigrade. And now, after a century of hard work and exploding computer power and everything, we now think it's 3 to 5 degrees centigrade. So that's what we've been doing with. But what's changed is that the temperature is actually starting to warm in response to rising CO2 concentration. So as recently as 1990, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said, well, there's not enough warming yet to discern it above the natural noise of natural variability, but we predict that by the end of the century, we will be able to pick out global warming for sure. And actually, it came earlier than that. In 1995, the IPCC said that there was a discernible human impact on climate. So ice sheets and glaciers are melting all around the world. It's very difficult for a young glaciologist to find an advancing glacier to study anymore because they're all receding. I think there's one in Norway. The warming that has been observed is reproduced in all of these plots as the thick gray line there. It's sort of there was a period of warming from around the turn of the century to about 1940, and then a period of slight cooling from 1940 to 70, and then warming since then. And if we try to explain that using only rising CO2 concentrations, we miss this initial hump and things look terrible. And so you can still hear people say, well, obviously global warming is a myth because look how terrible it looks. But when we put together both the anthropogenic, which means human-caused, and it's a funny word, anthropogenic sounds like you're making people rather than coming from people, but that's the word that we're stuck with. You put together the anthropogenic and the natural forcings, then you can explain the temperature trends in the last decades quite well. So, you know, by the normal rules of science, here's an explanation. It's the simplest explanation, and it works. And so, you know, there you go. This is what the various forcings of climate change look like. So these are all in units of watts per meter squared. So a watt is a unit of energy, like a hairdryer or a car stereo or something. And all of these plots have the same, 1 watt per meter squared is the same distance on the plots. So at the top, you can see that the sun warms up and cools down a little bit over the decades, not a whole lot. Here is the warming impact of greenhouse gases, primarily CO2. There are other greenhouse gases like methane, but CO2 is the big one. Aerosols, these are, this is sort of haze that comes out of coal power plant smokestacks. And it reflects light back out to space. And so this is this leads to cooling. And then volcanoes put haze up into the atmosphere too, enough of it all at once that you get a really high climate forcing, but it's a very spiky thing. It's a very short-lived thing. So the last big volcano was Mount Pinatubo that cooled the Earth down for a year or two by a half a degree or something like that. But the point is that if we want to explain that last uptick of warming sort of here, the only way we can do that is with the greenhouse gases, because none of the other forcings look like that. You can hear people talk about the climate impacts of cosmic rays or solar variability or anything like that, but none of those can explain the warming that we've seen. So none of those are a good competing theory to global warming. So this is what the forecast looks like. It doesn't look so terrifying, you know, on the face of it. The forecast is for 2 to 4, maybe 5 degrees C of warming globally averaged by the end of the century, by the year 2100. Warm air can hold more water vapor than cold air. So with a warming of the globe comes a slight warming in the average precipitation by a few percent. So that doesn't look all that terrible, really. But we'll put that into a context of variability in the past and get a better idea for what that looks like. So one of the pieces of the global warming response that Arrhenius picked up with his pencil and paper back in 1896 was that the warming is more intense in high latitudes. So you can see from the colors here, it's more pronounced in the bottom figure, that the high latitudes are warming considerably more than the tropics do. And this is because ice, when it exists, is very reflective and it shines sunlight back out to space. It reflects the light. When you melt the ice by warming a little bit from the CO2, you then absorb that sunlight, and so you get extra warming. So this is called an ice albedo feedback. Albedo means the reflectivity of the ice to visible light. And so that's why you get more warming in places like Alaska and Siberia than you do other places. And you see that in the temperatures today, actually, already. So I realize this plot may be a little small for you to see the specifics, but this is a plot of the model response of the landscape of the surface of the Earth with time. And you know, you won't be able to pick out Toronto and what's going on, you know, where your aunt and uncle live in Tucson or whatever, but if you just kind of take off your glasses and look at the maps, you can see at the high northern latitudes in the top plot, which is the present day, you have all of this tundra and desert and polar desert sort of high latitude biomes, and those all sort of vanish by the year 2300, which is the end of this simulation. Okay, so now to sort of broaden our scope of examination a little bit, looking into the past, We have thermometers that go back to about 1860 that are reliable. Fahrenheit invented the first thermometer, and very quickly thereafter, the temperature scales became standardized, and the freezing and melting points of water, those are sort of invariant things that you can calibrate to. So we have records of temperature going back from thermometers pretty far, but they don't go back forever. Earlier than that, you have to put together what they call proxy records of climates, which you do by looking at the thickness of tree rings. Trees grow better in a warmer, a warmer year than a cold year, for example. Or you can measure the temperature down inside the Earth and try to figure out what the profile with depth tells you about the changes that have happened in the surface. There are all kinds of clever ways that people have of putting together climate records. And so basically what emerges is a period sort of in the late part of the last millennium called the Little Ice Age, when the Earth was maybe a degree centigrade or so colder. Now, it's not clear if this was a global thing or if it was mostly in the Northern Hemisphere. Most of the tree ring records and things like that are from the Northern Hemisphere. So, you know, there's some caveats, but on the order of a degree colder or so. Before that was a time called the medieval warm climate or medieval optimum climate, which may have been a half a degree warm or so. So putting the present into the context of the past, the present-day climate, about 0.6 degrees warmer than the long-term average, is kind of comparable maybe to the medieval warm climate. There are those who say warmer, others who say no. But in general, it's sort of the same order of magnitude. These climate changes in the past were real, and they were significant, but they weren't sort of globally catastrophic, really. The medieval warm had associated with it a tendency toward prolonged multi-year droughts, what they call mega droughts in the American Southwest that sort of wiped out the Mayan civilization. So they probably wouldn't have had good things to say about the medieval climate. But globally, it wasn't a disaster. It was sort of a subtle thing. And that's what I would say we are, you know, in now. Nobody says that we're, you know, suffering here and now yet, really, from global warming, although residents of Pacific Islands, you know, may differ on that. So first lesson from the past is the present-day climate is sort of comparable to these medieval warm or little ice age kinds of climate changes, which are real and noticeable, but they're not globally catastrophic. If we look back further into time, now we're getting our data from ice cores. They actually can dig out little bubbles of ancient atmosphere from the ice and measure the CO2 concentration. And they see that going up and down. This is the present day before global warming. The CO2 concentration is now probably off the screen at about 380. And then here are some records of temperature down in Antarctica. So the global mean temperature change between the glacial time and the present day was about 5 or 6 degrees C. So that now is getting, actually, that's even larger than the temperature change that's forecast for the coming century. But, you know, they're sort of comparable. They're sort of an ilk. They're both bigger than a half a degree like we've seen so far. And the transition from the glacial time to the present day, that was a huge climate change. There were, you know, miles of ice above our heads right here during the glacial time. You could tell the difference from space that, you know, the climate was different during the ice age. That was a big deal. So the temperature change in the coming century to the year 2100 is sort of more comparable maybe to the temperature change at the end of an ice age, a much bigger deal. We sort of don't want to confuse what we've seen so far with what we're going for in the coming century. But the temperature change in the future differs from the temperature change coming from the ice age because now we're venturing off into new territory. We've been the Earth has had ice sheets and has been roughly kind of the same package of temperatures and climates for about 2 million years. And so to get to temperatures that are 3 degrees warmer than today, looking into the past, we have to go back, you know, 3-5 million years into the past. So, you know, that kind of ups the ante a bit because we don't know so much about what the world is like when it's that warm because the last time it happened was a long time ago. So the temperature change is comparable to a deglaciation, but it's getting to a state which is unlike any that we have seen in millions of years. And then another sort of note from the past, which I'll just make in passing, and we'll kind of see again a little bit, is that the forecasts, remember I showed you the temperatures kind of ramping up, you know, to 3 or 5 degrees C by the end of the century, and the rainfall sort of slowly ramping up. Well, in some ways, that was a best case scenario, because in the past, climate changes, as often as not, tended to be more like flickering light switches or something like that. They wouldn't change gradually the way the forecast does from the climate models, but rather the climate would tend to flip-flop from one stable state to another, just in a few years, you know, just a change. So, you know, that would make a transition more difficult if it happened all of a sudden like that. Okay, looking at the future, this is kind of something that you may not have heard before. The, you know, comparing global warming in the coming century to climate changes in the past, you know, that's kind of geology 101 sort of stuff, and I haven't put any original ideas into that. That's, I'm just sort of showing you that. But the prognosis for the deep future, this is something that isn't widely mentioned in the policy discussions about global warming. So we release CO2 into the atmosphere, and it does a number of things on a number of different timescales. The most important thing that it does in terms of how much CO2 participates in it is to dissolve in the ocean. So ultimately, some 3/4 of the CO2 that we release to the atmosphere will dissolve in the oceans, and this takes a few centuries. Actually, scientists back in Arrhenius' day figured that any CO2 we release to the atmosphere today would dissolve in the ocean next week, because, you know, the ocean covers 3/4 of the surface of the Earth, and so, you know, who's to think that it wouldn't just totally dominate the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere? Arrhenius didn't think it would be possible for humankind to do that. But it takes longer than that because of the way the ocean circulates, and so we have to wait several centuries for that to happen. The terrestrial biosphere, the land surface, also takes up carbon and releases carbon, depending on whether, you know, trees are cut down or we're protecting a forest from forest fires or fertilizing it from the nitrate from acid rains or something like that. And that also adjusts on a time scale of centuries. And then there are processes where the CO2 reacts with rocks. So CO2 is chemically an acid. Calcium carbonate is chemically a base. And so the two of those, well, the CO2, when it dissolves in the ocean, will tend to acidify the ocean somewhat, something that you may have heard about. It's an issue that's getting, there was a New Yorker article just a week or two ago about that. And then ultimately, after some thousands of years, the calcium carbonate will neutralize that base. So it's like you have a sour stomach and you take a Tums. Tums is calcium carbonate. Maybe you don't have Tums up here. Maybe you call it something else. I don't know. And then there are also chemical reactions with igneous rocks that will ultimately take down the bitter end of the fossil fuel CO2, and that takes hundreds of thousands of years. So what it looks like is this. We're now looking at a time span of 40,000 years going across the whole thing. And then here is, well, I guess we are right about there. But if CO2, if we burned all the coal, CO2 could reach this high of a concentration, it would, about 3/4 of it would dissolve in the ocean on a time scale of centuries, and then the rest of it would be this sort of long tail that takes thousands of years into the future. So 25% or so doesn't go away in just a few centuries. And this is kind of this has gotten missed because this is sort of an error on the part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. They got it right in the detailed chapter, you know, back on page 897 or whatever, but in the technical summary, they put into this table, table one of this summary, that the atmospheric lifetime of CO2 is 5 to 200 years. And now, I mean, once it's there, it's everywhere. You find that on the United States Environmental Protection Agency website. You find it in popular books on climate change, all kinds of things. There was one book recently by James Lovelock, the guy who came up with the Gaia hypothesis, which is that the Earth is a living, breathing thing. He talks about engineering the climate back to some you know, cool, if it gets too hot, we can always sort of engineer it back down, cooling it by putting some smoke up in the stratosphere, analogous to volcanoes. Well, you can maybe consider doing that if the problem is going to last for only a century. But if it's going to last for 10,000 years, you know, we can't sign for that. That's too much. So it's not just me that says that the CO2 has this long lifetime. It's not a difficult calculation, actually. These are all model studies that I've seen or reviewed. This is all of them. I'm not hiding any of them from you. And it's not really a difficult calculation. I could show you just with some thermodynamics and a piece of paper why there's this, why all the CO2 doesn't dissolve in the oceans, for example. But just to look at these different models, you see in the CO2 peak, something like 50 to 70% of the carbon that we release over the whole time period that we're releasing CO2 will be in the atmosphere at the time of the peak. Of course, that depends on the timing. If you released it all, you know, in an instant, then that next instant it would all be in the atmosphere. This depends on releasing it over, you know, a few over decades and a few centuries. But then the tail comes in here. After 1,000 years, you still have 30, 40% of the CO2 that was released still in the atmosphere. After 10,000 years, you still have 10%, 15, 20%, something like that. So it doesn't all just go away. And then here is a record of a climate event from the geologic past that also corroborates this. This is an event that happened 55 million years ago called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. So we are going from here to there in time, left to right. These plots, they flip them. You have to check, see which way time is going. Paleoclimate people have this weird thing. I don't understand. So we're going along, and everything's kind of fine. And then there's this spike of CO2 that's released to the atmosphere. And it's not clear where that comes from. It's actually, we don't have direct measurements of CO2 because there are no ice cores that go back that far. This is actually a measurement of the isotopic composition of C13 and calcium carbonate, which tells us about CO2. If you want to hear it, I can go into it, but you can just take my word for it. This is sort of a CO2 proxy. CO2 spikes up, temperature spikes up, and both of them recover back on a time scale of about 100,000 years. So it doesn't go away in 100 years. It lasts for much longer than that. So if we assume 3 degrees C for as a number called the climate sensitivity. That's how much you warm the planet in equilibrium if you double the CO2 concentration. So that was a number that Svante Arrhenius calculated, and he got about the same. Maybe he got 4 degrees. He got 4 to 6 degrees C for that. But if we assume 3 degrees C, which is kind of a standard model result these days, then we can figure out the temperature change going into the deep future, 1,000 years or 10,000 years into the future, depending on how much carbon we ultimately release. So these units here are probably esoteric to you. That unit is gigatons, which means billion metric tons. And to give you an idea, the fossil fuels, most of the fossil carbon is in the form of coal. There's much more coal, like 50 times more coal than there is oil or natural gas. And 5,000 gigatons is sort of a standard estimate for how much traditionally mineable coal there is. So this bottom line is if we go to town and burn all the coal. That would take several centuries. 2,000 gigatons is just a little bit more than the business as usual scenario to the year 2100. So, you know, this is sort of a moderate burn, and this is a large burn. And so you get these temperature changes of 3 degrees, 5 degrees, looking off into the future. So why is that important? Well, another lesson we can learn from the past is that sea level is very responsive to global temperature. So this is a plot of the temperature of the Earth on this axis relative to today, and on the vertical axis is the sea level. And so when you make a big ice sheet, the ocean level drops because you put all the water in the ice. And so the last glacial maximum time, 20,000 years ago, temperature was about 6 degrees colder than today, and the sea level was 120 meters lower. The Pliocene, 3 million years ago, that was before we had ice even in Antarctica. No, I'm sorry. That was before we had any ice in the northern hemisphere, like Greenland. And the sea level was maybe 20, 25 meters higher, and the temperature somewhat warmer. This is an ice-free state 40 million years ago, before there was ice even in Antarctica. And if you were to melt all the ice today, you would get about 70 meters of sea level rise. So there's this correlation between temperature and sea level in the past. Okay, now in red, we see the IPCC forecast for the coming century, which is, as we've said now a couple times, 3 degrees C of warming globally. And they forecast the sea level rise to be a half a meter or 1 meter of sea level rise, which is totally off of that historic line. And the reason why it's off is because it takes a long time to melt an ice sheet. And it takes a long time also to warm up the deep ocean. So some of the sea level rise in the forecast for the coming century is just because of the thermal expansion of the water. And both of those processes take time. But we have time. The CO2 has this long tail. The CO2, if we stick to a moderate carbon burn, we get 3 degrees of warming for 1,000 years. And if we go to town on all of the coal, we can keep the 3 degrees going for 10,000 years. So, you know, if we have all the time that we need to melt an ice sheet, then we're talking about vastly more sea level rise than what's forecast for the coming century. Now, we're not going to be around in 1,000 years, 10,000 years. I'm not arguing that we should base our decision-making process in the here and now on something that's happening in 10,000 years rather than sensibly worrying about what's happening in the next 100 years. But just for the sake of curiosity, I'm just showing you what happens on the longer time frame. So historically, according to the geologic record, 3 degrees of warming is a very big deal. And you can also make the case that the models that were used to forecast the sea level rise are too sluggish, because there are all kinds of things that happened in the past which the models can't reproduce. There's a new IPCC report coming out in 2007, which doesn't have that error in Table 1 anymore. I can vouch for that, I believe. But it still bases the sea level rise forecast on models. You know, I mean, you can't really fault them for that. What else are you going to do? And there's a very clear, you know, caveat in the report that says that, the reality, you know, your mileage may vary, essentially. The reality may be greater than this because models, you know, may be too sluggish. But for what it's worth, the way an ice sheet works is if it's cold down at the base of the ice sheet and the ice is actually frozen to the rock, the ice sheet will be very sluggish and it won't move by very much. And so an ice sheet, you can make an ice sheet move in a model if you heat it at the surface and then the heat has to diffuse down through the ice and it takes thousands of years to affect the bed, which is where the action is. But the real Greenland ice sheet, we see fluctuations in the flow rate of the ice sheet in the summer versus the winter. The real ice sheet can respond to warming in a couple of months, not 1,000 years. And the idea is, the thought is that it's because meltwater, water that melts at the surface, is somehow able to go all the way through this ice sheet and then lubricate the bed at the bottom. And nobody really understands how this can happen because it's colder than freezing down inside that ice sheet. And so, you know, we would expect the water to freeze on the way down. But here's a picture of water flowing down into the Greenland ice sheet. It's called a moulin. This picture is now, it was on the cover of Science a few weeks ago, and it's now kind of reached iconic. You'll probably see this on t-shirts, you know, very soon, this picture. There are measurable earthquakes around the edge of Greenland, which are attributed to the ice moving against the rock. And you see, so there's two different kinds of earthquakes in these plots. The gray ones are non-glacial earthquakes, so those are just sort of garden variety generic earthquakes. And then the green ones are glacial earthquakes, the ones where the ice is flowing. And you see that they accelerate in the summer. And you see also that they have been accelerating through time. So here's 2000, and here's 2005. And so there's been this acceleration of the rumbling of the Greenland ice sheet. There are events in the past which can't be explained by the ice sheet models also. One class of these events are called Heinrich events, named after a sediment oceanographer named Heinrich, who discovered these layers of rocks in his sediment cores from the North Atlantic. So these are big rocks. They're things that you couldn't carry around in the wind. They couldn't be windblown. The only way to get them there was as carry them is in icebergs. So the only way to make a huge layer of these things all the way across the Atlantic, as far south as Spain, is to have the Laurentide ice sheet just collapse within a century or so, spawning what they call an armada of icebergs, which then drop these rocks all over the place. They are thought to have raised sea level by maybe 5 meters in a century or a few centuries. And we don't really understand how these worked. We can't make a model do this. And so we couldn't possibly forecast if Greenland was going to start doing it. We could tell you that if it does start, there's no way we could stop it, but we can't tell you whether it's likely or not. There was a time interval during the end of the last ice age when the ice sheets, the Laurentide ice sheet, was melting, sort of going from the glacial maximum to today. It's right here. It's called Meltwater Pulse 1A. And this was a sea level rise of 25 meters or so, 20, 25 meters, within 1 to 5 centuries. So, that's a huge sea level rise. We can't even tell you, there's still dispute about where this water came from, which ice sheet it was that did it. We can't tell you, how it did it. We don't, the models don't do this. So, big question is, how long will it take for sea level to rise? If we're talking about a big warming, like 3 degrees C or more, and if the ice sheets in reality are, know all kinds of fancy tricks that our models aren't hip to yet, then the question is, could we get a massive amount of sea level rise like that in a shorter time than IPCC has forecast? So just to show you what this looks like, my 12-year-old son showed me how to paste images into Google Earth. I don't know if you've played with Google Earth yet, but you shouldn't install it on your computer until you've got a long rainy weekend ahead of you, because you'll just play with it for hours and hours. So what he showed me how to do was to paste in areas that are within 20 meters of sea level. And so I could just look around the globe and see this. And it turns out that one of the places that's, one of the big headline places on the Earth that gets hard hit is sort of the east and Gulf coasts of the US. Florida, you see, kind of gets it from both sides. Another is the low countries of Europe, Holland and Denmark mostly. And then there's this river delta in China. So I also had, at one point, I don't have it here because it kind of confused the plot too much, but I had colors of population density of the Earth. And it's astonishing. The population of China is so much higher than it is of the US or Canada, not because it's such a vast country, but because it's just really crowded. The density is huge. And this whole region here, which is within 20 meters of sea level, cuts right into the heart of the population density of the planet, really. So I wanted to go on now and tell you about the progression of ice ages on Earth and how the fossil fuel CO2 kind of compares with that. So we don't really understand very well the progress of ice ages. We know that it's correlated in time to variations in the Earth's orbit, and in particular that the intensity of sunlight in the northern hemisphere summer seems to be very important. So when the orbit is such that you get a really hot sun in the northern hemisphere summer. So in other words, when the summer, northern hemisphere summer is at a part of the Earth's orbit that's close to the sun, the ice sheets melt, and when it's cold in the northern hemisphere summer, you grow the ice sheets. The summer is what's important because it's always cold enough to snow in the winter, right? But in the summertime, if it's too warm, then you melt the snow and you got to start over again next winter and you don't make an ice sheet. Whereas if it's cool in the summer, the snow can kind of accumulate and start to make an ice sheet. But there are all kinds of details that are not very well understood. So what I'm going to show you is based on a sort of a three-state model by a French guy named Didier Payard. And we're only interested in one part of this. We start from an interglacial state like we're in now, and if the summer sunlight at 65 degrees north drops below a threshold and we're in this state, then you flip to that state. So you nucleate an ice sheet. And so this is his sort of idealized sequence of ice ages. So here is the ice volume. Here's the present day. Here's the last glacial, and here's the last interglacial, and sort of going back and forth. So the interglacials are generally these dark splotches here. And then here is Payard's progression from interglacial to glacial. And he makes the case that, you know, the transitions line up pretty well. Here is the sunlight forcing at the northern hemisphere summer. And when it drops below this threshold, that's when you go from a interglacial to a glacial time. So this is the trigger that we're going to look at, is the summer sunlight summer sunlight intensity at 65 north. So we can get this same kind of trigger behavior in a climate model. What we did in this model is we started out with an orbit that guaranteed that there was a warm summer sunshine at the beginning of the model run, and we slowly changed the orbit so that the northern hemisphere summers would get colder and colder, and then all of a sudden, blam, it nucleated an ice sheet at a sort of a trigger value of the sunlight intensity. And then we keep getting colder and colder, and the ice sheet sort of grows, and then when you go back warmer again, you overshoot, because once the ice sheet is there, it reflects sunlight, and so it sort of stabilizes its own existence. This is that ice albedo feedback again that Arrhenius discovered. So now setting the stage for this calculation, we've got CO2 in the top panel. So here are the glacial interglacial cycles of atmospheric CO2 concentration, and they don't look very dramatic there because they're kind of squished together, because I've also superimposed the future trajectories of atmospheric CO2 concentration given different sizes of the fossil fuel release, the slug that we release. And remember, 5,000 gigatons of carbon, that was basically all of the coal. And then on the second part of the plot, we have the sunlight intensity at 65 north in the summer again. And then the green line here is the critical trigger value. And so according to Payard's model, we are in interglacial states whenever, you know, where there's a green dash here. Those are Payard's interglacial times. So you see where we are at the present is right there. And the sunlight at the northern hemisphere summer is actually getting rather close to the critical trigger value. So there's all kinds of disputes in the scientific literature about whether the next ice age is sort of coming in the next 1,000 years or so, or whether it's not going to come until sort of the next time around there, which is about 50,000 years into the future. You see that the variation in the sunlight intensity is not as extreme in the near future as it was 20,000 years ago, and that's because the configuration of the Earth's orbit is currently such that it's nearly circular now, and so it doesn't, you don't get the variations in the intensity of the sunlight. I would say that this is sort of a too close to call kind of a result, that we don't know the critical trigger that well to be able to say, you know, who's right and who's wrong in a natural world, whether the next ice age would come, you know, in the next 1,000 years, couple thousand years, or maybe not until 50,000 years from now. But this critical trigger idea of Paillard's, this was based on the natural CO2 concentration in the natural atmosphere during a normal interglacial time, which was about 280 parts per million, what it was in our interglacial until about the year 1750 when it started going up. So in this model that predicted this, that got this same sort of trigger behavior, we ran the same thing again with different CO2 concentrations. And we found that the value of the trigger where the ice sheet suddenly formed depends on how much CO2 is there. So if you have more CO2 in the air, that kind of warms things up. And so you have to have a deeper cut in the sunlight intensity in order to make that ice sheet start. So higher CO2 values and a lower value of this critical trigger sunlight intensity, fewer watts per meter squared of sunlight. So if we take the CO2 trajectories for the future here and we run them through that last relationship with the critical trigger value, this is what happens to the trigger in the future. It goes, you know, way down like that. So that it's, if, you know, we were to burn 5,000 gigatons of carbon, we're now way outside of the range of orbital sunlight intensity variations. And we could avoid another ice age for 500,000 years, something like that. It's a really deep time impact. So here we see the interglacial periods, the model saying that we would have stayed in interglacial for 50,000 years anyway, although, like I said before, it's sort of too close to call. The 1,000 gigatons of carbon prolongs it until, what is this, 130,000 years, and 5,000 gigatons of carbon, like I say, 500,000 years. And then here's sort of a crude estimate of Earth's temperature. It just shows that the effects of releasing CO2 now can persist for into the geologic future. Now, I also live in a place that used to be covered with a mile of ice. Chicago is not that far from here. And so I would be the last one to argue that we need to save the next ice age. The next ice age would probably not be good for, you know, my real estate values or yours either. But I guess I would say that this shows that we have now sort of taken the reins of the climate of the planet, or at least we have the potential to if we burn all the coal, and that natural cooling is unlikely to be able to come in and sort of save us from ourselves, I guess is how I would. So there's another way that a long time climate change can have a more profound effect, perhaps, than a quick climate change. And that is with these methane hydrates. So these are sort of water, a weird form of water, that where the water molecules form kind of like a soccer ball kind of structure. And they have to have a gas inside them to stay steady, to stay stable. And you can make these hydrates out of all different kinds of gases. But it just turns out that there's huge amounts of methane frozen in these sorts of deposits in the below the seafloor at the bottom of the ocean. Actually, there's as much methane in these deposits as there is coal. There's like 5,000 gigatons of methane in these deposits. So methane hydrate, I mean, here it's on fire in this person's hands. It's not my hands, by the way. But even if it wasn't on fire, it would very quickly melt. They're not stable at the Earth's surface any place because there's not high enough pressure of methane. So even in Antarctica, these wouldn't be stable at the surface. And down at the bottom of the ocean, you've got the pressure to keep them there, but they would float if they didn't have mud sort of holding them down. They're just like ice cubes in a glass of water. So they seem like the most precarious of things. And methane is actually a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2 is. So if just 10% of all this methane somehow pooped out to the atmosphere all at once, it would be the climate equivalent of increasing the CO2 by a factor of 10. It would just be, you know, like a science fiction disaster movie. just totally apocalyptic. So I've done calculations with a colleague of mine at Chicago to figure out, to predict the how much methane you would expect to find in the ocean as a function of temperature. And so at the present day temperature of the ocean, we get about, you know, something like the observed answer of 5,000 gigatons or so of methane. And then in a warmer ocean, eventually we calculate that you could decrease that inventory to 1,000 gigatons of methane or something like that. Now, this is the steady state change. It may take millions of years to get from one state to another. There's no, we're not claiming, nor do we believe that, you know, this is all going to happen right away if the temperature goes up that quickly. But it does show a strong sensitivity of this methane reservoir to the temperature of the Earth. And if we have tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years to work with, then maybe the biosphere could ultimately release as much carbon from these hydrates as we release from the coal by burning it, sort of a matching funds kind of thing. So this is our model of where you find these hydrates. They tend to be found kind of in the sediments that are close to the shore, because that's where there's the most biological production, dead plankton sinking down to the seafloor, and they, you know, they get buried and ultimately they turn into methane and get frozen into these deposits. So the colors here that we're looking at are the fraction of the pore space between the sediment grains that's taken up with bubbles of methane. So this is bubbles down below the hydrate deposits. So one theory today is that if you get 10% or more of the volume in the pores filled up with methane gas, then that gives the enough power for the methane gas to bubble out through the surface. So if we melt some of this hydrate, you see the volume of the bubbles going up. So there's, you can see it sort of coming to life there. Now the calculation we get is that still not that much would come out in hundreds of years. So we're not, you know, trying to raise any sort of doomsday scenarios here. But on the long time scale, this is something to consider. So the bottom line about hydrates is that they probably won't catastrophically blow out in the coming century, because it takes so long to warm the deep ocean and down into the sediment where the hydrates are found. But on timescales of millennia and longer, the hydrates could release carbon that would match the carbon that we release. So it could sort of exacerbate, could double the long-term climate impacts of fossil fuel carbon release. So to conclude the discussion about the long timescales, you may be wondering, well, why do we care? And I can't answer that. You know, we won't be around in 10,000 years. So in any practical sense, we have absolutely no reason to care about something that's that far into the future. On the other hand, we also have no practical reason to care about the longevity of nuclear waste. You know, if it lasts 10,000 years, that's, what's the difference to us? If it lasts 100 years, it's all the same. We won't going to be around anyway. And yet people do seem to care. It does seem to be, I think if, you know, nuclear waste was shown to be just a 100 years sort of phenomenon, people might feel differently about it. And I personally feel differently about, you know, filling up my gas tank with gasoline and putting it into the air, given that a quarter of what I release is going to be affecting climate for, you know, the age of human civilization. I don't know, it gets to me somehow. I don't know why. So to end on an upbeat instead of a downbeat, what is there to do? We have already emitted about 300 gigatons of carbon from fossil fuels and from deforestation. So that's the same unit, 300 versus the 5,000 is all of the coal. I and my collaborators calculate that we could ultimately emit, this is a fuzzy number because we don't know everything perfectly, but ultimately about 700 of those same units to just barely avoid what they call a dangerous climate change of 2 degrees C. Now those are sort of fighting words, dangerous climate change, because some people will attack you for saying, you know, for implying that anything less than 2 degrees C is safe, which I wouldn't do, or saying that 2 degrees C, I mean, that's, you know, it's 2 degrees C colder out there now than it was this morning. You call that dangerous? It's sort of a personal, I mean, it's a judgment call is what it is. But 2 degrees C would warm the planet more than has been seen in millions of years, and so that seems like a reasonable discussion point about what we consider to be dangerous. So if we say that 2 degrees C is a dangerous climate change based on the history of temperature, based on history of sea level, stuff like that that I've shown you, we calculate that we could emit about as much carbon, maybe a little more, as has already been done, and just barely avoid exceeding that danger limit. So the 400 gigatons that we haven't released yet that we could conceivably release without passing that danger limit is about equivalent to the rest of the petroleum and the natural gas deposits. Coal is really the big fossil fuel. Coal is where the thousands of gigatons are. So we could burn all of the looks to me like we could burn all of the oil and the gas and just stop burning coal, and that would probably just about do it. Not so easy to do, obviously, but when you put it this way, it doesn't sound so bad, right? Okay, so thank you very much.
This is obviously a topic that has a great many people's attention. So I can assure you that I won't spend all the time just talking to Professor Archer by myself. I'll get it going with a few questions, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So I'd like to begin. Well, first of all, thank you very much. That was a wonderful talk. Very, very stimulating. This is an issue which has so many interesting effects. Obviously, there's the real scientific effect, but there are issues of public policy, there are issues of scientific literacy of the populace, and there are issues involving the role of the media. And I know myself, sometimes I get dragged into these sorts of issues, and occasionally people will ask me, well, what do you think of climate change? And my default is to say, I don't know, largely because that's my default to a lot of questions. And also because in this case, I don't know didn't know very much about it. But like many people here, I'm sure, and elsewhere, I was under the impression that there was this wide-ranging controversy. I thought as a dynamical system, it's very complicated. I don't know anything about climate. It's nonlinear. It's cyclical. I don't understand any of the details and the models. And one reads the newspapers, and one reads magazines, and one gets the sense of a raging controversy in the scientific literature. And so I started to do a little bit of research myself, and I think, as is certainly witnessed by what you said this evening, it's quite clear that, at least in my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there is an overwhelming scientific consensus of the principal issues that are at play here. Through the International Protocol on Climate Change, through scientists, climatologists around the world. And in fact, Al Gore mentioned this in An Inconvenient Truth. He talked about the disparity between the real scientific consensus on the core aspects of the issue as opposed to the media portrayal of this. And I know you personally have taken columnists from the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal and so forth somewhat to task for their behavior on this. So my question to you is, why do you think this is the case? I mean, is it just a question of the media trying to stir up controversy to sell newspapers, or is it some flagrant misunderstanding as to the way science is done and the conclusions that are reached? What's your view on this?
I think it used to be much more prevalent when you read an article about global warming to find the sort of he said, she said attempt at balance on the part of the journalist by quoting, there's a sort of small cadre of climate contrarians who will kind of treat the issue the way maybe a lawyer would treat it, not claiming, not somehow going for the truth the way a scientist would, but rather presenting an argument, you know, the best arguments you can to try to reach a
desired conclusion the way, you know, works in our legal systems. I don't see that as much anymore. Now I see columns by people like George Will or others who have an agenda that they're trying to, you know, push forward. But I don't really see the false balance so much in the, I mean, you know, journalists go to see Inconvenient Truth too, so they're wising up to that, I think.
Well, but let's look at the remaining skeptics, and I'm sorry to be harping on this, but I think it's important, and I think it's important certainly if you look not just at George Will and the like, but members of the Republican Party and so forth. And the standard line which is trotted out is, well, these people are enslaved to big oil and big money and power, and they want to make sure that they do anything, they don't do anything to limit their natural constituency, and it's all real politic and so forth. And at one level, one can understand that. But at one level, if one actually takes that deeper and says, okay, if I'm George Will, or if I'm George Bush, for example, presumably, at some level, there's a sense of just denying the scientific consensus and just saying, well, that's just rubbish. That's not the case. And there is a lack of willingness to engage from any of these skeptics, because at some level, even the staunchest opponents of the Republican Party would certainly agree that George Bush loves his children and loves his family and would like his grandchildren to be living in a prosperous society and so forth. So is this just a question of the people who are skeptical sticking their heads in the sand and not willing to confront not just this particular piece of scientific evidence, but the whole way that science actually is done? Or is there something else going on?
Well, you get there's a natural impulse, I think, among humanity to question all kinds of very clear and obvious things, like HIV causing AIDS. You can find Nobel laureates who deny that, and a lot of times the climate contrarians also don't believe that smoking causes cancer, and you know, there were arguments that seatbelts were, you know, going to drag the economy down. I mean, there's just always going to be two sides to any issue, just given the way human beings are, I think. I do think that there's certain willful denial of reality in political circles in my own country, for sure, not just about this, but on all kinds of issues.
So let me ask you one more question before I turn to the floor. You said stop burning coal. Let's imagine in the real world we're in, you are elected, since we're imagining, we can imagine a midterm election, and you've just been elected President of the United States. And I'll give you both houses of Congress as well.
Wow.
So here, but everything else is real. We're still in 2006. We still have a real economy. We still have real constraints and so forth.
How do you stop burning coal?
What should we do?
Well, you can burn it, or there are other things you can do with it to extract energy. There's a technology called integrated gasification combined cycle, which treats the coal with steam and produces hydrogen and carbon monoxide, and the carbon monoxide can be burned to get energy from it, and it gives you a stream of pure CO2, which is then much more easy to capture, and you can sequester it down in the earth. There's all these places, saline aquifers, the sort of sandstone layers filled with salty water that nobody would ever want anyway, is the idea. So you could just squirt CO2 down in there, I mean, it sounds dangerous because what if it came back out? That would be bad. But on the other hand, there's methane natural gas that's been down in the earth for millions of years, so it's not infeasible that it could be done. So it costs more to build an IGCC plant, and they're still sort of experimental and temperamental, and you know, it's not like falling off a log the way building a coal-fired power plant is. But if you burn coal, what you get is a mixture of 80% nitrogen and then 20% CO2. So you have to separate the CO2 out, and it costs energy to do that. And so if you actually build in to your assumptions when you're making the decision that you want to sequester the carbon, it's cheaper to go with the new technology than to go with the old. And yet in the US, we are going bananas building new coal-fired power plants. There are 160, 158, something like that, new plants that are either being built or that are on, you know, in the planning stages of being built. And these things are good for 50 years. So, you know, investing in building these things now is just, it seems foolish. So that's one thing that we could do right now. I mean, whether we could, I mean, to make the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere stop going up, we would have to cut our emissions by about half. And in the US, we already are burning twice as much carbon per person as two people in Europe or Japan. We're already twice, I mean, we should cut by half anyway, and just to be on a par with those other places. But globally, the emissions have to be cut by half, which means that in a perfectly, you know, fair world where every person was releasing the same amount of CO2, the average citizen of the US would have to cut by 90%. And this is the real world, that's not gonna happen overnight, but at least we could start going in the right direction by developing these new technologies rather than sort of going for the dinosaur option and trying to grandfather it in. Sure. So one example I like to think of is telephones in Israel, for example, or in India. They never installed landlines in lots of places. They leapfrogged because in the meantime, we developed cell phones, and you know that was a much cheaper thing for them to adopt, and so they just went right to the good stuff. Well, the same thing could happen with energy. We could, you know, we got a lot of smart people. We could develop these technologies to not release CO2 and get energy, either from IGCC or from windmills, or I've heard all kinds of great ideas for really big energy payoff. Solar cells on the moon, I heard a talk once. You beam the energy back to the Earth in microwaves. Yeah, that was great. I loved that. We could start doing that. You know, if we took it upon ourselves as a challenge, we could do that, and then the developing world would be able to sort of leapfrog over the destructive technology that we've been indulging in.
Of course, as you say, that is an issue. It's a huge issue with India and China coming increasingly online and developing, economically developing so robustly. There's going to be an increasing exponential demand, in fact, in energy. So this problem, unless creative solutions, leapfrog-like solutions, such as you're suggesting, are manifest, it's going to be increasingly problematic as we move forward.
The one of the mechanisms for controlling carbon emissions that's built into the Kyoto Protocol is emissions trading. And so if you have some old inefficient power plant, you can upgrade it and make it efficient. And if you can beat the target that has been sort of allotted to you from this mechanism, you can sell those credits to somebody else. And so I've heard that invoked as a means of sort of luring the developing world into the Kyoto framework because they could make money at it.
Just for the benefit of everybody here and listening overseas and everywhere else.
And the ships at sea.
And the ships at sea, indeed. Perhaps you can refresh our memories and clarify matters with respect to the Kyoto Protocol. So my understanding is that the goal, that should the Kyoto Protocol be signed and effective and so forth, the goal is to reduce emissions down to something like 6% of 1990 levels. Is that
6% below
1990? That's right.
So 96%.
Yeah.
So that was sort of a 6% cut, and you know it's only the first step because to really stabilize CO2, it would have to be cut by 50% or something, so that the rate at which CO2 is released is balanced by the rate at which it's going into the ocean. So therefore, the concentration in the air wouldn't go up anymore. So that is going to expire in 2012, and there was just a meeting in Nairobi a few weeks ago to work on the successor to that. They didn't actually come up with it yet, but they meet every year, twice a year, something like that, in an ongoing sort of process. The you know, Kyoto didn't happen in one meeting either. They have these conference of parties, these COP meetings every year all around the world, and Kyoto happened to be a breakthrough, and Nairobi happen to not be a breakthrough, but I assume that by 2012 they will come up with the next stage of the agreement. And, you know, 6% doesn't sound like it's going to save the world, and it's not, but it sends the economic signals that we should start, you know, building IGCC plants instead of coal-fired power plants and things like that. It sets things in motion that will have impacts beyond just that 6% is what I like to hope.
But given the difficulty that many countries seem to have at meeting the Kyoto Protocol, that must put something of a crimp in your optimism.
I confess that whether I think that, I mean, you know, global warming is the biggest environmental problem that mankind has ever had to solve. It's a global problem. But if the roof is leaking over your head, it's in your interest to fix it, right? Because it's just affecting you, and you fix it, and then it's fixed, and that's good. But as a problem gets bigger, it gets more difficult to negotiate fixing it. And so a global problem is the most difficult of all. And not only is global warming global, but it's also has this immense time duration. So, you know, we benefit now, and then the world pays for it for, you know, 10,000 years into the future. That gets even, I mean, you can't really imagine a problem that's going to be more difficult to solve, going to require more cooperation, really, than that. So whether I feel like, you know, yeah, we could beat this, or whether I feel like it's hopeless, that sort of depends on my mood, to be honest. I don't know what to believe.
Well, let's hear what people here have to say or ask. If we could perhaps turn up the lights a little bit. There's somebody right back there who has a question.
That was a wonderful talk. Thank you. And unfortunately, my partner's stuck studying. So, I was wondering if there's anything practical that you could talk about regarding the changes in ocean currents that seems to be taking place, at least when it comes to trying to go to the Maritimes in the wintertime.
Well, there are changes that can be measured in the circulation and the temperature and salinity of the oceans. The ocean has such a long response time that it's hard to know if what we see is sort of natural decadal variability or whether it's really something new and different. So the ocean current that people like to watch out for is this overturning circulation in the North Atlantic. So you have heat that's carried up into the high northern latitudes, and then the water sinks down and then makes room for more warm water to come up. And after the last ice age ended, so there glacial time, and then there was 1,000 years of basically interglacial climate, and then there was this this lake of fresh water in North America that was dammed up by the ice sheet, which suddenly was released to flow out into the North Atlantic. So you put this freshwater cap on top of the ocean, and that's buoyant water. It doesn't want to sink anymore. So it kind of put a stick in the spokes of that overturning circulation, and the climate of the northern hemisphere sort of plunged back into a glacial state, and it happened, you know, in just a few years. And so that silly movie, The Day After Tomorrow, was about, I mean, that's the seed of truth that got, you know, grown into that hideous movie a few years ago. And they do measure changes in salinity in those waters, but a talk I just heard last week actually reported changes in temperature that just sort of compensated for the salinity. So there was a sort of a skeptical view that maybe this is just natural fluctuations. It's not really clear whether, you know, anything is going on there or not. Most climate scientists that I have talked to about this, who are, you know, betting people, are wagering that by the time you had such a shutdown, there'd already be so much warming that the cooling would, you know, not, you know, the warming would surpass the cooling. The reason why this could shut down again is not because of a glacial lake the glacial lake Agassiz, it was called, that ran off into the North Atlantic, but because Greenland is melting, and so if Greenland sort of dumps a lot of fresh water. But by the time it does that, the warming would already be greater, is what most people think, than the cooling would be from this conveyor belt shutdown. My feeling in general is that we would never know that the climate has this, or would have in the glacial world, this, you know, flip-floppy kind of character in it if we hadn't seen it in ice cores and sediment cores and things like that. So obsessively measuring that particular current is kind of like the generals always fighting the last war. You know, it's the next thing that we can't anticipate that that I would worry about more. The ocean has the ability to kind of hold the climate into some new state for a long period of time. If there were no ocean, you'd only have to run an atmosphere model for a year or two, and it would be in equilibrium, and nothing would ever change. But the ocean has this sort of ponderous character to it. In particular, these long-term droughts, like the one I talked about during the medieval warm time that wiped out the Mayan civilization, those are thought to be they're thought to get their inertia in part from changes in the ocean temperature. So the ocean has this possibility of kind of locking in things into some new state and keeping it there for a long time.
You have a question at the back there?
Yes, I guess that's me. I must admit that after your presentation, I'm even more pessimistic about there being a solution to this. And it's probably caught up in that title, Geologic Time. When you think about what you've been saying here, I mean, there's the movement of the plates that may wipe out San Francisco. There's this huge volcano under Yellowstone that apparently is overdue for eruption. That the last time it did that, it obliterated almost all of life in the United States and most parts of Canada. There's the possibility they're talking about the asteroids hitting the Earth and so on and so forth. This whole damn place is dynamic. And we're all going to suffer in some way or another. Maybe the Russian traps will explode once again and obliterate what was once called all of life, about 96% of it some geologic time ago, because that's the time scale we're dealing with. Mankind's been around for 10,000 years, probably won't last another 10. I mean, I read Jared Diamond's book on collapse, and he's got me convinced we're all... So, in the end, why isn't the solution, instead of going through this expensive, indeed unlikely... I just don't see any of us doing this, what you've been describing. Why don't we just roll up our pant legs, for those of us that wear pants, and get the hell out of those areas that the sea is going to inundate, move our cities. Wouldn't this be cheaper, at least last some time until that explosion takes place in Yellowstone or the asteroid hits? Oh,
okay,
and
so
it's a lot cheaper.
I'm going to have to cut you off, inspiring though that may have been. I think the... What amounted to a question there is why don't we just move?
We could all move to Canada.
We could all move. I was going to say that many of the catastrophic events you were talking about actually did pertain to the United States. So this could be an immigration boom for us. There's a question.
Well,
over
actually,
there. Did you want to respond with something inspirational?
Well. Why don't we all just roll up our pant legs and live with it? I mean, there is a sort of economic field of trying to compare the costs of global warming against the costs of avoiding global warming. And it's very interesting, you know, the things that they have to put together to try to make that calculation. And you know, to value the natural world is really a difficult... It ends up sort of valuing coral reefs the same way as it would value Euro Disney or something like that in terms of tourist dollars. It loses something, but if you take it for what it's worth, there are a lot of people who are working along those lines. But there's this fundamental issue of fairness involved in that.
the people who suffer, who would suffer the most from climate change are not the people who are benefiting from business as usual. There's a huge disparity in the toll extracted by natural disasters, you know, tsunamis, earthquakes, you know, whatever, between the developed world where we have lots of ambulances and things and the developing world where they don't have that infrastructure. And then there's also the unfairness in time. We're talking about, you know, a century of doing things the cheap way and then leaving the bill to people for thousands of years into the future. That's sort of unfair. So it seems to me that just if we want to live with ourselves, if we want to be, you know, ethical people and just be able to look at ourselves in the mirror without self-loathing, we need to address this issue just on the grounds of fairness. And then on the grounds of economics, the models that I've seen don't predict that it would be catastrophically expensive to avoid dangerous climate change. A few percent of GDP every year, which sounds like a lot of money, and it would be if you piled it up into a pile right here, but on the other hand, you could imagine, what if we had reached this stage in our development and we were out of fossil fuels? Do we think that we'd be, you know, living like the Flintstones? I don't think so. I think we could come up with, you know, ways of making energy and going on and enjoying our lives just as much and not really noticing the difference. You have a person in the, you know, you plug something into the wall, you don't know if it comes from coal or from windmills or what. I think it could be almost a transparent change. So I can't help you with the Siberian traps, however, and Yellowstone. That there, we're all just, you know, on our own.
But I think there is a point, and you allude to this in your book as well as just now. When you talk about the economics, often people tend to be overly despairing and they give up. But there are solid economic arguments as to how to go forwards, and there's a solid economic framework to be able to specify the problem. In your book, you mentioned the tragedy of the commons. Categorization of the problem, which maybe you can speak to for just a minute. And you also mentioned this notion of cap and trade as a way of being able to somehow deal on a widespread level with this particular issue. And there are precedents of that having been quite successful with acid rain and so forth. So sure. Perhaps you could speak a little bit about that as well.
Well, the tragedy of the commons is a situation where a person who benefits from making a decision doesn't pay the costs of it. So a farmer buys one more sheep to graze on the common yard in the village center, and that affects the productivity of all the other farmers and their sheep. You know, they all suffer. So everybody pays the cost of that sheep, but only one person gets the benefit. And so the incentive of each individual farmer is to put as many sheep onto the commons as possible because he's not paying the cost. And that in economics is called an external cost because it's external to the guy that's making the decision. So one way to avoid that is to divide the commons up into little pieces and say, okay, Bob, you get this piece and Jane, you get that piece. And so you put another sheep on there and it doesn't affect anybody but you. You own that piece of land now, and so that cost is not external anymore, it's internal, and it causes you to be a better steward of the land. The atmosphere, you can't really divide it up into ownership that way, so because it, you know, it flows around, and if we release CO2 here, it affects the climate in China. If they release it there, it affects it here. So the other alternative is with some sort of regulation, gasp, hate to say it, some sort of communal, oh, that's right, I'm not in the U.S. anymore. That's so refreshing, I love it here. So you set a limit, you put a tax on emitting carbon, so you're taking the external cost and you're making the person who makes the decision pay that cost. So that's a lesson from economics. Another is that if the economy is growing at some rate per year, say it's growing at 3% a year, and then you cap, you put a tax on it of 3% every year because you have to get your energy from an IGCC plant, which is a little more expensive, or windmills or something, than you know, cheap burning of coal. Those are different 3%. So it's not like the growth rate then goes from 3% to being zero. So you take 3% every year off, and what that means is that the growth trajectory is exactly what it would have been, but just delayed by 1 year. So say we would have had $100 this year, $103 next year, but now we got to pay $3 every year to the clean energy factory. Then we got $97 this year, $100 next year. So we have $100 just a year later. And then the other lesson from economics that you mentioned was this idea of trading emissions, which, I mean, it sounds odious. You buy the right to pollute. But what it actually does is it shifts the cost, the cutting of the emissions to whomever can do it the most cheaply. So if you've got some big power plant that's emitting huge amounts of CO2 and for, you know, $10 you can make it stop emitting that CO2, and then there's another plant over there that it would cost $100 to do the same thing, the way it'll work is you'll do the cutting locally where it's cheap, and then you'll sell the permits to the other guy for, you know, $50 or something. So you'll make money and he'll save money off of making the cuts there. And so this was done in the US to regulate acid rain, which actually there's a little bit of a problem that can arise if you let all the acid rain be emitted from one place. It'll still have a bad impact right at that place. So you sort of want to spread it out, ideally, which cap and trade doesn't do by itself. But CO2 is perfect for that because it doesn't matter where it's released. It's a global issue. And the result with acid rain in the US was that it cut the emissions at a far cheaper price than anybody had dared hope. For the cap and trade with Kyoto, it seems like it's having kind of growth pains. The cost of the permits that get traded depend very sensitively on how many of them are allocated, so how ambitious you make the cuts. And little changes in the allocation have caused these huge spikes and gyrations in the costs of those CO2 emissions permits. And then the fact that the whole thing is coming to an end in 2012 means that if you're not certain what's going to happen, maybe instead of making some capital investment to your power plant that will cut your emissions for, you know, 30 years into the future but would cost a lot of money now, maybe it'd be safer to your stockholders or whatever to just buy the emissions trades credits from somewhere else. So the fact that the whole thing winds down soon is undermining a little bit the long-term effectiveness, is my understanding.
Thank you very much. And on that optimistic note, I'd like to thank you once again for a very stimulating evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.